The Guardian reported that actually New South Wales government has spent nearly $500,000 on court cases that they've lost against pro-Palestine protest groups, in particular Palestine Action Group in Sydney. And in fact, I'm just looking at the report now. And in fact, the final bill to the taxpayer is yet to be finalised. Now, a lot of this has come about because of we saw the really, really egregious scenes with the police abusing and really hitting protesters who were rallying against the visit of Isaac Herzog in February. Now, the state's Court of Appeal actually struck down the laws in April after finding they impermissibly burdened the implied constitutional right to freedom of political communication. And this is a very important point. The state of New South Wales actually had a cost order granted against it. So the three activist groups which were represented in the court case had their legal bills paid by the state of New South Wales.
Which is sort of fascinating, isn't it? That it's sort of like, please explain why you're attacking your citizens.
There is that, and which is disturbing enough. But what I really find disturbing is, according to this report by The Guardian yesterday, Chris Minns was of the view that the laws were valid.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? So, and he hasn't been charged with contempt of court, which is interesting in itself. It does remind me of a thing. Oh no, I won't say it. It's too inflammatory. I won't. It's just that when you think of scary and aggressive people, you don't usually think of people in suits that are nice and neat, do you? Which is what Minns likes to project. But obviously, there's more to that.
Yep. And I think just to expand on that, the legal consequences. There's a nice quote from Professor Emerata in Constitutional Law, the University of Sydney. Professor, that's Anne Toomey, and she said she gave this warning. History tells us that anti-protest laws rushed through Parliament often have an unhappy ending in the courts. So that's something to consider when legislation that is rushed through and ill-considered and not given appropriate consultation at leads to draconian measures, as we've seen in Sydney and also in Queensland.
Also it does tell you about the balance between and the separation of powers, which is one of the three things that are required for corruption. You have to suborn your courts, you have to suborn the government, and you have to suborn the police. They're the three areas of concern. And so it's a good sign, actually, that the this has come to fruition in this way. One of the good signs, there's a certain robust nature to the Australian democracy. If this case has, been thrown out of court effectively. Another one of those kind of things is the Australian All Work reports, you put this in the hat, that the Australian Commonwealth Bank reversed customer service job cuts after an AI voice system struggled to handle call volumes and customer needs, prompting the bank to restore positions. IBM also found limits to automation after deploying AI to manage most routine human resources requests. While AI now handles the majority of standard inquiries, the company said more complex situations still require human judgment. And it was the little bit at the end that really got me. IBM, this is how it was expressed, IBM has since announced plans to significantly increase entry-level hiring in the United States, citing the need to maintain a future talent pipeline.
Yes, that corporate speak again, that really erodes the language, the English language.
Yeah, but also the place of humans within it.
Yeah.
And it brings in the local resentment now around this holus bolus creation of data centres all around the place, which effectively are being built to not only spy on people but take their jobs.
Yeah, and an important thing to note is that these data centres are not like the data centres that started to exist around about 10 years ago because they used to generate power for search engines. These data centers use vast amounts of water, gas, and land. And the whole thing is, I was listening to a lamestream media during this week, and they had a really good analysis. That's actually Thursday's episode of lamestream media of AI. And they actually pointed out that the actual business case, the actual valuation in a lot in these AA companies, it seems that it's overvalued.
Yeah, they are.
To paraphrase Scott Mitchell, what he was saying, it's like as if that they are developing a user case. Like they don't actually have like a proof of concept as such. You know, the investment is going to generate, that they say, is going to generate something.
Yeah. Basically they have to sucker everybody into believing that it's inevitable. And obviously the people who are in the governments, very few of the people who are representing us seem to have done their due diligence. This has been going on for quite a while because I've been to a couple of big end of town stuff about this for over the last decade, because it started off with it's inevitable and it's going to be the big new industrial revolution. Now, the interesting thing about the industrial revolution that happened, our history books generally call it a bonanza and brings us to our present level of wealth. A certain part of the world's wealth, which has been siphoned off by almost every other parts of the world, have siphoned off into a group of European states. But the level of pain and anguish and death that was caused by that industrial revolution, maybe someone's quantified it. But obviously, for a lot of the humanity, what has resulted is not a rosy picture. Effectively, it's not a rosy picture, and you'd have to think about what they're now going to expect ordinary people to have to sacrifice for the next industrial revolution, even if it is, you know, a huge con. You know, it's a con. Effectively, it's been created as a con. It requires the people who are being conned to accept it as an inevitability. That's my point. It's a bit disturbing. I'll tell you something else that's a bit disturbing. According to the McDonald's loses a lawsuit against Chef Jamie Oliver, who's fighting the good fight, who proved that the food they sell is unfit for human consumption because it is highly toxic. Oliver demonstrates how hamburgers are made. According to Oliver, fatty cuts of meat are washed, in inverted commas, with ammonium hydroxide and then used to fill the hamburger patties. Even before this process, the TV presenter says this meat was unfit for human consumption. Oliver, and he's called a radical activist chef, I think he's just a person who is a qualified chef and is on humanity's side. We are talking about meat that is sold as dog food and then served to humans. Aside from the quantity of the meat, ammonium hydroxide is harmful to health. What sane person would put a piece of meat soaked in ammonium hydroxide into a child's mouth? In another initiative, Oliver demonstrated how chicken nuggets are made. After the best parts, in inverted commas, are selected, the rest, fat, skin, cartilage, eyes, bones, head, feet, is subjected to a mechanical separation process called caniska, a euphemism used by food engineers. This blood pink paste, which is deodorized, bleached, refreshed and recolored, it is then coated in flour and deep fried. It is typically fried in partially hydrogenated oils, in other words, toxic substances. The food industry uses ammonia hydroxide as a antimicrobial microbial agent allowing McDonald's to use meat in its hamburgers that is unfit for human consumption. Even more alarming, however, is the fact that these ammonia hydrogen pass substances are considered legal components of the production process in the global food industry with the approval of health authorities. Consequently, consumers will never know what substances are in their food. Scared?
It doesn't sound like it's fit for human consumption.
You know what? I have never in my life bought anything except a smoothie from McDonald's, ever. I've never eaten a McDonald's thing, ever.
Oh, I think growing up, I probably went to McDonald's for like the Happy Meals and things like that. But no, I haven't. I don't go there because that's just not healthy food to eat, basically.
Be scared. Be very scared. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was this thing about, I went to a rally recently. It was the rally that the council workers were doing, and I was having a chin wag with the pretty cynical guy who does the sound systems. Because, you know, over time I've had I get to know these people and, you know, he's a nice guy and we have a yarn and he has political views. But what he was saying, he said this thing that was quite interesting to me, which was that, oh, you know, of course these people don't get enough money. But, you know, if their wages go up, then of course it's a vicious cycle. Inflation just continues. And I thought, that's interesting, because that's the common belief that increased wages is the cause of inflation. And I thought I'd let you hear a contrary view. In fact, this is exactly, you know, of course, the argument runs that by asking for better wages, workers are the fuelers of inflation, at fault for their wages cuts because a below inflation wage increase is a wages cut, you know, because if you don't get more than the inflation, then you're actually not getting an increase in your wages. Alison Pennington, chief economist at the McHale Institute, advances the argument that in fact privatisation and marketisation is driving inflation and the cost of living crisis in her recent speech at the New South Wales Teachers Federation conference. What she is saying is that McHale Institute's findings set to be presented at this conference, the research found that while the CPI ran at an average 2.9% per year, the fastest rising costs driving total inflation were all privatised services outside the public system or services formerly delivered for free or at a low cost by a government. Among those items was gas, which, according to the McHale Institute's analysts, recorded an average annualised inflation of 5.9% over the 20-year period. Electricity, meanwhile, rose at an average of 5.7%, while medical and hospital services reported an average inflation of 5.5%. Secondary education, in which multiple private operators are active, rose by an average of 5.2%, water and sewerage by 4.6%, and housing and preschool and primary school care by 3.9%. Remembering that the overall inflation is the average is 2.9% per year. However, consumer goods such as clothing, appliances and computer equipment got cheaper over the same period, according to the report. So she says, Alison Pennington said, the analysis exposed a 20-year transfer of income from workers to private companies delivering essential services and contradicted prevailing narratives around the RBA's rate rises.
That's very interesting research you've spoken about there, Annie. I think it again reveals the fallacies of the neoliberal thinking and privatisation, which, you know, started in the 80s, and it was, you know, we're meant to bring all these benefits, but obviously not, as per Alison Pennington's research. It seems to, you know, the whole mantra of that privatisation was meant to make things cheaper for people. Well, that doesn't seem it's demonstrated empirically.
Well, no, if you say something three times, people will believe it. Doesn't mean it's true. Mm. And it's the same with data centres. We've gone around in circles.
Yeah.